want to have permit parking on your street.
Talking with Matt Farrell of Public Works. Matt, on June 10th, you go to City Council with the permit parking. What actually are you bringing back to City Council that hasn't been decided up to now? In other words, I know that they've decided on the permit park, the whole city has a permit parking area, correct, in April?
They set up the potential to set up permit parking zones throughout the city, so now it's more... It's easier to do it in terms of adding to zones or establishing new zones.
Right. This was set up in April.
Right. It was by council.
So what are you coming back with in June? What exactly?
Well, here we're establishing a whole new permit parking area.
The downtown one?
Yeah. And since we haven't ever had a program downtown, we felt it was good to bring it to council for review and approval so that council would have an opportunity to review the particular parameters of this program, as well as give the public a chance to speak to it.
But it's not required now, unless there's an appeal, if you set up other parking areas, is that correct?
That's correct.
So normally the process would be it goes to the Transportation Commission, and then if someone appeals it, it then can get to City Council. Is that my understanding? Is that accurate?
Well, additions to existing permit areas?
No, let's say, well, let's suppose an area that isn't part of the six previous areas, or the seventh area of the downtown is added, a new area, but it's still within the permit parking area of the city, which I understand you now in April passed.
It could be done administratively without going to the Transportation Commission.
Oh, really? So it doesn't have to go to the Transportation Commission?
No, not necessarily.
Now, the current proposal, the mode by which people get the an area set up for permit parking is they need to have, is it a certain percentage? What's the process?
There's some, you know, basically what we try to do is look at what the, in terms of residential permit parking programs, we look at what the issues are in terms of occupancy on the street and do some street occupancies. In terms of adding streets, people can circulate petitions.
How many people on the street do I need to
ask people to have? The new resolution, I think, calls for...
could be to say, I don't know.
I don't recall.
It's either 60 or 67%.
I think it might be 67% now. It used to be 60%.
Is this per street, or is this...
This is on the block basis where we're adding streets to a zone, you know, like, say, an established zone.
Right.
But then we may add additional streets to that zone because we may say if we're going to add this particular block, the block next to it may be added
if
all.
If those people want to object, then I understand that will happen. Because 60% of you get a 60% objection rate, you can add those streets. Is that accurate?
That's right.
And so, in essence, you could add the rest of the city to a permit parking zone, should you choose. I'm not saying you would. And unless people objected with a 60% petition, it would be passed even without a hearing at the Transportation Commission, if you so wished.
I don't think there's likely that that
would
happen.
But it is, in fact, possible now under the new law.
Conceivably, it could happen. But
I'm just trying to get my facts straight.
Quite unlikely.
The other question I have for you as a homeless...
a lot of signs to make.
More work for the sign makers. This is a difficult economy for those sign makers. There was a provision that worried a number of us, which said that people who have vehicles parked at night, even in metered zones, commercial zones, and free parking lots, as well as residential areas, there would somehow be a bar on overnight parking. Now, I understand it was modified to say only residential fronts, but is this something that is, again, a matter of administrative discretion? Could this be changed without even approaching the Transportation Commission, have the entire city ruled out of, you know, have an overnight parking ban citywide? I'm not saying it would happen, but could it happen under the current law?
Currently, what we're proposing is in the downtown neighborhood, in the areas, in the residential area. This would include the area around the high school, as well as the residential frontages in the street. Those would all have a parking prohibition between 1 a.m. and 5 p.m. Without a permit.
Without a tow-away provision?
No tow-away. And then in the commercial floor, we wouldn't have any overnight parking prohibition.
I understand.
In terms of adding streets, usually we'll do it in response to requests from neighbors, businesses, or the police department. We won't be putting these controls on the street unless we get a request.
We use the Public Works Department.
Right, exactly.
And you are, in fact, the key agency. If somebody wants to add streets, they should come to you.
Right.
Now, what if people protest this or are finding uncomfortable or want more questions answered? What number should they call to get in touch with you?
My number is 420-5184.
And your official position is?
I'm the parking program spin.
Hey. Now, again, so I don't make any mistake. If you decide, your department decides, to make the entire city a no parking at night zone, you do not need to go any further than to make that declaration. It doesn't go to the Transportation Commission. It doesn't go to the City Council unless there's an appeal. I'm not saying you're going to do that. I know you aren't.
Well, you see, what we do in terms of adding a permit or adding a control on a street is we post the notice that it's going to be added or changed for 2 weeks. And during that period, there's a comment opportunity for people. If people comment that, you know, they want to go to the Transportation Commission, or they have a concern about the control, then we go to the Transportation Commission.
How many, is there a certain number of comments you need? You need one comment? You need a majority?
It's one comment to do that.
Now, is that something that you are still discretionary? You can say, well, this is Michael Tomasi complaining about his dog. We don't think that's relevant.
We haven't ignored any requests to consider these controls. The one area we've talked about, maybe not considering controls, is when a person requests an on-street handicap parking space, because sometimes neighbors complain about that, but we feel that they rarely get turned down, and it's kind of an access question. But we still haven't.
Again, to clarify this point, it is your discretion whether to take this matter to the Transportation Commission or not. You are not obligated by any kind of internal regulation or ordinance to do that. Is that my
understanding? Actually, I think this does talk about permit appeals here.
Well, if they appeal it, yes. But if you want to put a whole bunch of streets as a no parking zone at night, you can do so without going to the Transportation Commission or the City Council if you choose. And I'm not saying you would choose, but you in fact have that power, or am I barking up the wrong tree? Am I mistaken on this?
What we would do is we would post those streets before they're changed, so people would have an opportunity to express concerns about that change before it's implemented.
Let's suppose Saddam Hussein took over your department and decided he did not want...
He would still need to follow the practice that our department uses in terms of implementing these changes.
Which is?
That what we do is when people request a change, we post a notice on the street saying that we're going to make this change and comment on this change as loud for this period.
You get one complaint. Are you required to take it to, or is it discretion?
It's our practice that if people complain, you know, that's our policy, we take it to the Transportation Commission.
But it is discretionary, is that my understanding?
I don't think it's not specified in the ordinance, but that's our practice. That's our practice.
And I'm not denying that. I'm trying to take the hard line on this to get the specific understanding. So, you would then go to the Transportation Commission for discussion. And the Transportation Commission is the final vote on whether this program goes through or not?
Decisions of the Transportation Commission can't be appealed to the City Council.
Barring an appeal.
Then their authority would stand. The only other thing is that if staff disagrees with the Transportation Commission, it could take it to the City Council also.
Now, do you have to pay appeal fees, or just the people bringing in the appeal?
I think it's just the citizens.
So we get to pay you. It's very interesting.
That's pretty standard in terms of most of the city departments. The same thing applies, you know, with the planning department.
Are you driving a car these days?
I do.
Me too. Anyway, we've been talking with Matt Farrell.
I didn't drive a car today, but I
know. Walking is better for you. I'm going to do more walking myself. Anything you want to add that you think the community should know about this proposal, this plan, anything coming up on June 10th that they should be thinking about?
It's just an opportunity for people to come and express their opinions about the plan. Encourage them to do that.
What are the principal objections you've heard that have caused you to have some serious considerations about this that you've had to reflect on and respond to?
Well, I think the major concerns that we try to deal with are concerns about, you know, managing the parking around the high school, and also just trying to deal with how we would implement a program that allows some non-resident parking on these residential streets.
Now, the Transportation Commission, as I understand it, did not approve of the downtown project area. What's it being called? That's the exact name for the...
That's a permit area.
Downtown permit area. And they, in fact, requested that you hold back on this until July, when they could meet again and bring the matter to the City Council. Is this correct?
That's correct.
Yet you are not doing this. You are proceeding to a June 10th City Council meeting. What's the need for the rush?
Well, the goal is to try and have the program in place by January of 2004. And we need to have a program approved in June so that we can start with the steps of implementing the program, set up the, order the materials for installing the signs, set up the work program for that, order the permits. We need to do some training to get people in the office working on this program.
Anger management classes for those who attack the different employees.
Oh, and we need to also increase the staffing in the parking office if we're going to handle this area because it's a big area. So that person will need to be recruited.
So you see a time crunch.
Yeah, there's a...
Transportation Commission had its doubts. What were their major concerns?
Well, I don't have all that information right in front of me, but they had concerns about the pricing of the permits and also how we were going to manage the revenue from the program and also about the high school parking proposal.
Have you informed members of the Transportation Commission that their request that this be postponed until July is, in essence, being countermanded and it's going to council on the 10th?
We told them that the night of the Transportation Commission.
Did anybody get upset and start shouting at you and cursing?
Well, we didn't have any cursing accounts.
Well, luckily, things were very mellow. Thank you very much, Matt. Appreciate
it.
Okay, we're talking to a man enjoying a peanut butter sandwich with a bit of Pepsi outside of Zanato's. It's dusk, almost, about...
So that was... thanks. That was Matt Farrell in an informal interview with me on June 2nd talking about permit parking. And as you can see, to me, the key issues are now the old permit parking, there were five or six permit areas, but you had to, you couldn't operate except within those permit areas. You could add street by street, but a majority of people had to ask for inclusion. Now a majority of people have to ask for exclusion. And you also still had to go back to City Council to make changes on this issue. Now you don't. You just have to go to the Transportation Commission, but only then, only if the Public Works wants to take it there. They say, well, we do it if we get complaints. That's our procedure. Well, they do what they want. If Michael Tomasi or Robert Norris complain, are they going to take it to the Transportation Commission? I don't know. It's not mandated by law. And once the only way you can get it to City Council is with an appeal, which you can pay for, but the staff, if they don't like the results, gets their own appeal independently, which they don't have to pay for. In fact, you're going to pay for their appeal because you pay their salaries. So the whole process is top-heavy with destruction of public process, which has, of course, been the hallmark of city councils for the last 5 or 6 years at least, and probably before that as well, but it's become more intensified. I'm going to try now and do a little musical segment, and then hopefully we're going to end up the hour by playing some of the actual tape from the from Sergeant Chavez and Mr. Martinez. Chavez is the sergeant who essentially went into the hospital van after this guy was shot 5 times and demanded again and again answers from him in an interrogation, essentially concerned with exonerating the officer's behavior, not getting evidence of any crime, but exonerating him in a civil liability suit. Here's a guy torturing another guy, and the city attorney spends taxpayer dollars to defend that position before the Supreme Court, our city attorney in Santa Cruz. We're going to get to that in just a moment if we can get it booted up. In the meantime, we're going to have this.
Civil defense sign. got more signs than yours. More signs. More signs. I've got more band-aids, more ice cubes, and more iodine, just in case it hurts some friends of mine. Sign. You'll know it's time to go when the siren starts to blow. Remember the civil defense sign. I won't be the one to die. To die. To die. Of course, a certain percentage just has to go. But I won't be the one to die. Make the missile so Daddy will have a job. A job. A job. When the missiles start to fly, we can all lay down and die. Then Daddy won't have to work anymore. But when you see this sign, it's time to go. This sign, this sign. You'll know it's time to go when the siren starts to blow. Remember the civil defense sign. Remember the civil defense sign.
That was an old number from Broadsides, the Best of Broadside, and that was Civil Defense Sign by Mark Spolstra. I think that was back in the early 60s. Civil Defense Signs are back in the 50s, but hey, they're coming back. You know, it's retro city here in the U.S. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is the end of Bathurst Spears Broadsides. And before we play the segment that I mentioned to you before of the actual torturing on tape, the officer had his tape recorder on, the sergeant did, of the man in the case where the city attorney is supporting the Supreme Court decision that says it's okay, that kind of torture does not make a police officer liable, only just that evidence can't be used in court. Before we play that, I'm going to kind of conclude my show. And I'm just going to leave that segment running. This is a segment from Democracy Now, May 30th. But you can actually go to the Democracy website and get that, www.democracynow.org, and you can just listen to it yourself. But I'm going to play it for those of you who don't have that kind of access or are computer illiterates like me. Georgia has been helping me boot it up. I want to thank her for that. And then you'll be hearing some more material. George will be covering that, and then we'll be going, hopefully, some music, because I do a lot of talking on this show. Before I go, though, just a couple of quick things. I said I'd give an update on the Iraq situation. I haven't got time to really do that. I just want to say that you see creeping back into the news media the fact that the U.S. is under attack in Iraq. And the spin being placed on this is that these are hardline Saddam Hussein loyalists who have hidden in corners of Iraq, are engaging in planning terrorist activities, and are finally being caught by the U.S. as it moves out from the cities. You see, it hasn't had a chance to move out since this is the latest spin. In fact, of course, there's a variety of groups attacking U.S. troops in Iraq, ranging from Shiite clerics to indeed, no doubt, remnants of Saddam Hussein people, to folks who are just angry at the failure of the U.S. to make good on its commitment of turning over the Iraqi government to the Iraqis, to those who are outraged by how the U.S. military are operating on the streets. And the latest deal, which you can check by going on the internet, maybe it's even made it into the papers, they're, you know, giving away teddy bears and toothbrushes after invading people's houses and looking for weapons, because the weapons amnesty ended yesterday. Now they get to go in and confiscate everybody's AK-47. And Iraq, as I understand it, an unusual situation is one of these totalitarian societies under Saddam Hussein that kept its weapons. In other words, Hussein didn't confiscate people's weapons. They got to keep their weapons. I guess that he had superior firepower, or I don't know how he kept the gang in line. It's an interesting argument against those who say you're going to keep a dictatorship away by taking away people's, by letting people keep their arms, because that didn't seem to help the people in Iraq against Saddam Hussein. But that's an issue for another day. We're going to be talking more about these issues, I hope. I always say we are, and sometimes, usually, you know, it becomes a catch-as-catch-can situation. On Thursday, when I come back, I do a Thursday show from 6 to 8 in the evening. Look for increasing attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and increasing pretexts, excuses, and, of course, disproportionate counter-brutality by U.S. troops that killed, 90 Iraqis over the last few days, claiming that they were parts of terrorist camps. But then finally the media moves in some days later and finds that these people denouncing them, and this is actually coming over mainstream media, saying these were not terrorists, these were local people, these were Sunni Muslims who were attacked here. Lots of interesting stories. Captives deny Al-Qaeda worked with Baghdad is one headline. There's a lot of stuff which you can also get by going to the London Observer website. In any case, I don't have any more time for this because I want to get rolling. And what I'm going to leave you with is the invitation to come on downtown. I think tomorrow we're going to be trying to do some tabling downtown. I'm going to check out the downtown scene this afternoon, but I don't know if I'm going to be doing much tabling. It depends on who wants to do some tabling at the Pacific Trading Company, the group that, along with the Redevelopment Agency, brought us the new seatless area downtown. You can go sit in the sidewalk cafe and spend a little money. I mean, that's the whole point. We're going to stir up business downtown, right? I'll be downtown today, and I'll also be looking for, if you want to do any tabling tomorrow, give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and we will try to inform the citizenry and try to encourage them to stand up against this repression. This planter is the first of, well, it's actually the second, if you count the new leaf planter, which they removed. They're going to go after other planters, too. That seems to be the plan downtown. So let me know at 423-HUFF. Show up at the Huff meeting on Wednesday between 8:30 and 10:30 in the morning. You can do that. If you want, at Baker Square, 1107 Ocean, call the Huff line for more information, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And if you want to be on the show, you can give us a call there, and I'll be happy to arrange for an opportunity for you to speak your piece either by radio or possibly in person if you've got information about subjects that, you know, we've been talking about or subjects that we perhaps should have been talking about. We're going to go now to Democracy Now!, the May 30th show, and that, again, is the show where the Martinez versus Chavez case is mentioned, and that's the torture case. And it's all very well described by Amy Goodman. I don't have to say anything more. I just want to thank George for letting me have this extra time, and thank you all for listening. Again, give a call to 423-HUFF for any more questions or information, and stay tuned for some good programming here on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Today on Democracy Now!, an exclusive. We air for the first time the tape of a Los Angeles farm worker being interrogated by a police sergeant after being shot by police 5 times. Let me read a piece in the Los Angeles Times describing what took place. It begins like this. It was early evening on a November day 5 years ago when Oliverio Martinez, 29 years old, rode his bicycle down a path and across a vacant lot toward a row of small homes. Two officers, Andrew Salinas and Maria Pena, had stopped to question a man they suspected, wrongly it turned out, of selling drugs. When they heard a squeaky bike approach in the dark, they called for the rider to stop. Martinez dismounted and put his hands over his head. In a leather sheath on a waistband, he carried a long knife that he used to cut strawberries. When the officer patted him down and grabbed for the knife, Martinez tried to run. Salinas tackled him and tried to handcuff him. As they struggled on the ground, the officer called out that the man had a huge knife. Pena moved closer and fired. One bullet struck Martinez near the left eye and exited behind his right eye. A second hit his spine. Three more shots hit his legs. When patrol supervisor Sergeant Ben Chavez arrived, a handcuffed Martinez lay bleeding on the ground. Once Martinez was loaded into an ambulance, Chavez climbed in with a tape recorder in hand. On and off for the next 45 minutes in the ambulance and at the hospital, he repeatedly asked the gravely wounded man to admit he had grabbed the officer's gun and provoked the struggle. In agony, Martinez is heard screaming in pain and saying he's choking and dying. Chavez asks, "Okay, you're dying, but tell me why you were fighting with the police." He continues, "Did you want to kill the police or what?" One officer had said Martinez tried to grab his gun. In the emergency room, Chavez continued to press Martinez to tell him what happened. "Why did you run from the police?" Chavez is heard to say over the sounds of nurses and doctors. "Did you get his gun? Did you try to shoot the police?" Martinez, in a low voice, responds, "I don't know. I don't know." Lawyers for Martinez say he panicked when the officer tried to tackle him, but they say he did not grab the officer's gun. In the emergency room, he's heard asking Chavez several times to leave him alone. "I don't want to say anything more," he said. The sergeant continues, "No, you don't want to say what happened? It's hurting a lot. Please," Martinez implores, his words trailing off into agonized screams. Undaunted, Chavez resumes, "Well, if you're going to die, tell me what happened." Silence came only when pain medication took hold and Martinez faded into unconsciousness. That from the Los Angeles Times. The Supreme Court has just ruled that the police sergeant did not violate the Fifth Amendment right of Oliveira Martinez. He is now paralyzed and blind. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive. We air for the first time a recording of Sergeant Chavez interrogating Martinez while he screams in excruciating pain. The tape has never been broadcast nationally before. We're going to hear the tape in a minute. But first, we're joined in the studio by Oliverio Martinez's two lawyers, Samuel Paz and Sonia Mercado, as well as Alan Wysotsky, who is the lawyer for Sergeant Ben Chavez, who speaks to us from Los Angeles. But we'll begin with Samuel Paz. And I want to start by asking where Olivero Martinez is today.
Well, he continues to live with his father. They live in out in the fields in Oxnard, and they are field workers. And that was what he has always done. And so he continues to live there and is waiting for a resolution of his case.
The Supreme Court decision, Sonia Mercado?
Well, I think our opinion is that of Justice Stevens and Justice Kennedy, who found that it was just wrong of Justice Thomas and those who concurred with him that this was not a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And with Justice Stevens, who found that this is one of your classic cases of torture.
Well, let me put that issue to Alan Wysotsky, the lawyer for Sergeant Ben Chavez. Dissenting Justice John Paul Stevens compared the interrogation to, quote, an attempt to obtain an involuntary confession from a prisoner by torturous methods. Your response?
Justice Stevens wrote the dissenting opinion, which, of course, implies that there was a majority opinion, which clearly distinguishes this type of interrogation from that which Justice Stevens alludes. There are very specific guidelines under the 14th Amendment controlling the interrogation of individuals, whether they be suspects, witnesses, or bystanders, and that is the controlling amendment upon which this type of behavior is measured.
I wanted to play the tape that Sergeant Chavez made as he was questioning Oliverio Martinez, who had been shot five times. We'll listen, and then Sonia Mercado, if you could do some translation so people understand. This recording is made. Maybe you can describe the recording.
Well, the recording takes place in the emergency room when Mr. Martinez is being taken care of by emergency physicians trying to save his life. And Sergeant Chavez comes in and interferes with that and begins to interrogate.
Let's take a listen.
No! No!
Mr. Olivero keeps saying, I'm suffocating, I'm choking. Sergeant Chavez keeps asking, tell me what happened. Mr. Olivero keeps repeating, I don't know, I don't know. And he yells, I'm in pain, and he screams in agony. And he repeats, please, I'm dying. And the officer responds to him, yes, yes, you're going to die. Please, so tell me what happened. And that is the tape. Right now, the Supreme Court has made its ruling that the police sergeant did not violate the Fifth Amendment rights of Oliverio Martinez. Have they ruled on other amendment rights?
Yes, as Mr. Wasatsky was mentioning, the court, a majority of the court also agreed that Mr. Martinez can go back to the trial court, and if the trial court agrees that the level of coercion, the level of torture, in which the circumstances and at the time the statement was being taken, if that violates the 14th Amendment, then Mr. Martinez would have a right then for compensation for that.
And explain 14th Amendment.
14th Amendment is basically the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution, the Bill of that portion of the Bill of Rights, and it basically protects fundamental rights and abuses by government. Just to step back, though, I think the real tragedy in this case, and the reason that I think most people, most writers and most law professors and really the entire legal community is in shock, is because, and I'll just quote from the opinion of Justice Kennedy, he says, I submit, Justice Souter and Justice Thomas, I submit, should be more respectful to the understanding that has prevailed for generations now. To tell our whole legal system that when conducting a criminal investigation, police officers can use severe compulsion or even torture with no present violation of the right against compelled self-incrimination can only diminish a celebrated provision in the Bill of Rights.
Alan Wasatsky, your response.
Well, there's more to Justice Kennedy's opinion that I think goes squarely on point to what Mr. Paz and Ms. Mercado are suggesting, and that is on page 9 of his opinion, where he states, there is no rule against interrogating suspects who are in anguish and in pain. The police may have legitimate reasons born of exigency, which means born of urgency, to question a person who is suffering or in distress. Locating the victim of a kidnapping, ascertaining the whereabouts of a dangerous assailant or accomplice, or determining whether there is a rogue police officer at large are some examples. That a suspect is in fear of dying, furthermore, may not show compulsion, but just the opposite. The fear may be a motivating factor to volunteer information. The words of a declarant who believes his death is imminent have a special status in the law of evidence. So it has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis, measuring the government's interests versus the human rights and dignity of the individual being questioned.
Now, in this case, in fact, there were no charges brought against Oliverio Martinez, were there?
No, there were no charges, and all of the examples that Mr. Wasatsky just read, none of those existed. And that's the tragedy in this case. There was no exigent circumstances. There was no life to be saved. There was no reason to compel, except that the Sergeant Chavez wanted to build a story to protect the officers who had just shot Mr. Martinez. That was the only purpose for this questioning.
What about, well, respond to that, Mr. Wasatsky.
Well, you know, Mr. Paz has clearly eliminated the one phrase that Justice Kennedy referenced, and that's determining whether there is a rogue police officer. At the time Sergeant Chavez was interviewing Mr. Martinez, he was under the impression that the only two witnesses other than Mr. Martinez were indeed two police officers. And to allow this dying suspect or individual to leave this earth without sharing his version or account of what happened, clearly was of concern to Sergeant Chavez. And I assure you that had Mr. Martinez died and had Sergeant Chavez not made this inquiry, Mr. Paz and Ms. Mercado would be on the other side of the argument saying they had every opportunity to interview him and get to the truth of the matter, and they failed to do so, knowing that the only witnesses left were police officers.
Well, Alan Wasatsky's argument, Samuel Paz, that this was a compassionate act.
Right, and that just is fallacious as it sounds here. The district court also rejected that benign excuse that somehow this sergeant was going to go there to try to find out if there had been police misconduct. By listening to the questioning itself, you could see that Chavez is trying to put words into Mr. Martinez's mouth. He's preying on this man who is near death, and he's really taking advantage of the fact that this man is blind, that he's been drugged, he's on the operating table, and he wants to extract some confession from this man to protect the other officers. The benign argument was rejected by the district court. It doesn't fly. It's just, it's not to be believed.
We're talking to Samuel Paz and Sonia Mercado, the attorneys for Olivero Martinez, as well as Alan Wasatsky, lawyer for Sergeant Ben Chavez, who interrogated the shot farm worker in the ambulance and in the emergency room. We'll be back with them in a minute.
What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. You say, what is this? All the loving. Let's get down to business. Mental self-defense or fitness. Don't wreck the show. You got to call that what you know. To make everybody see. In order to fight the power, can't be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Public Enemy, Fight the Power, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, continuing with this Democracy Now! Exclusive. In the studio with us, Samuel Paz and Sonia Mercado, the attorneys for Olivero Martinez, who is the Los Angeles farm worker who was shot 5 times by 2 police officers, then loaded into an ambulance. A sergeant got in and turned on a tape recorder and interrogated him on the way to the hospital and in the emergency room. His attorney joins us as well from Los Angeles, the attorney for that sergeant, Alan Wasatsky. I wanted to read from a more recent piece in the Los Angeles Times, which says, after the Supreme Court narrowed the right against self-incrimination, ruling that police and government investigators can force an unwilling person to talk as long as those admissions are not used to prosecute them, the 6-3 opinion undercuts the well-known Miranda warnings in which officers tell individuals of their right to remain silent. It appears to allow more aggressive police questioning of reluctant witnesses in the hope of obtaining evidence. While the person's words cannot be used against him or her in court, evidence can be used. Samuel Paz, your response.
The tragedy is that what this case has done is really taken away a line of cases that were built on facts that you've just basically talked about, and that is where people were placed in interrogations, they were suspects, and they were questioned, and when they said, I don't want to talk anymore till I have a lawyer, the cops basically said, that's too bad, we're going to keep you here and you're going to keep talking. That's the kind of infringement, that's the kind of compulsion that the Fifth Amendment was meant, and historically, everyone has always believed that you have a right in America, you have a right to remain silent as part of our Constitution.
Well, let's put that issue to Alan Wasatsky, the attorney for Sergeant Ben Chavez. The Miranda warning begins, you have the right to remain silent. We never hear that in this tape. Did Chavez offer to tell Olivero Martinez about that right?
The answer to that question, Amy, is no. However, you have misstated or misread whatever the source is that you were relying upon as to the right protected under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And I have my memo pad that has the Miranda rights printed on it from my days with the Los Angeles Police Department in the late 60s. And it reads that you have the right to remain silent because anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. There is no absolute right to remain silent.
Samuel Pons?
And I think that that's what I find striking and shocking, that that's the argument that, unfortunately, that a number of the Supreme Court justices believe. I think that just goes against the entire grain and the entire historical development of the Fifth Amendment and the rights that this country we've grown up with the concept that you have an inalienable human right not to speak. And the concept that the Supreme Court is advancing is that, well, you only have that right if we use your statement and take it to court and then prosecute you. The concept is that you have a right to be left alone, a right in your human dignity not to be forced to speak. That is what we're looking at, is that now our government, and this was strongly pushed by the Bush administration, our government wants to say, well, a little bit of torture is okay, a little bit of coercion is okay. And I think that I personally find it repugnant. I think most Americans find it repugnant to think that now the government can say, we can force you to talk just as long as we don't use it against you. And that's what, I think that's the argument that Alan is advancing. And unfortunately, that's a tragedy in this case.
Well, that's absolutely incorrect. That's not the argument I'm advancing.
Well, one of the statements that the court does mention, Justice Thompson, for example, will still provide the Fifth Amendment right to someone like Mr. Lay before the Senate. So before the Senate, when we don't know whether they will be prosecuted or not, and they claim the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, I don't think Justice Thomas was promoting that then we could browbeat them and coerce them and not let them leave the chamber until they answer the question because we haven't prosecuted them yet. And so that shows the fallacious argument itself that the majority pushed forward, where it is very result-oriented, and it's not logical, because still you have the right, if you are evading taxes, to say I have the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent because you may prosecute me later. And I don't think that Justice Thomas in anywhere in his opinion got rid of those rights. So it's only when they want to prosecute either someone they may think is a terrorist or somebody they think may have committed a crime, or someone they just want to badger until they confess to a crime they never committed, as in this case.
Attorney Wysotsky, you said that the argument Samuel Paz said you're making is not the one you're advancing. What are you saying?
There are two distinct Bill of Rights amendments that are in issue here. The Fifth Amendment really deals with the self-incrimination clause, that you don't have to be a witness against yourself in a criminal action. In other words, you have the right not to speak, to remain silent, for fear that your testimony or statements may or will be used against you in a court of law. To suggest that the police are thereby empowered to use torturous means to gain confessions flies directly in the face of the 14th Amendment, which provides the protection that Ms. Mercado and Mr. Paz and the citizens of this country expect from the police. They are entitled to be treated with dignity and fairly, but at the same time, the police have a job to do, and it's a hard job, and they are entitled to use aggressive, sometimes coercive means to obtain information. Even Justice Ginsburg, in her dissenting opinion, probably the most liberal, if not certainly a very liberal member of the Supreme Court, references examples of when police are very much entitled to make inquiries of individuals, even though they choose not to speak or want to speak.
I wanted to
play the tape again. When you put forward the idea that Sergeant Chavez was being compassionate in allowing him to present his story, and just listening to Oliverio Martinez respond to this. Again, this is in the emergency room. Five times. Is that right?
No, he was pointing the gun at them and they defended themselves.
That is not those are not the facts, because if he had pointed the gun at them, Mr. Wysocki, with all due respect, your officers would have filed charges, criminal charges against them, as is very usual in the Los Angeles area. And further, Sergeant Chavez, not once, Mr. Wysocki, and I think the tape speaks for itself, ever asked any questions of Mr. Martinez regarding the other officers. His only questions were to Mr. Martinez, and his only questions were, you were holding the gun. And it was he who started that line of questioning. So if he was interested in a dying man's declaration, he would have asked some questions about what did the officers do, not one questioning what the other officers did.
Well, let me put that question to you, Ms. Alan Wysocki. You said that he was holding a gun, was threatening the officers. So why wasn't he charged with threatening them? Why wasn't he charged with perhaps attempted murder?
Well, you're speaking, frankly, to the wrong individuals. The Ventura County District Attorney's Office is presented with every case of this type, as they were in this matter, and for whatever reasons they determined that there was insufficient evidence, that Mr. Martinez himself has suffered penalties worse than any judicially mandated sentence may be, could very well have influenced their decision not to proceed with the prosecution of this case. And I can assure you that Mr. Salinas and Ms. Pena, the officers involved in this altercation, will testify and have testified that they were both very much in fear for their own safety and well-being, and have the absolute right to defend themselves.
Will there be a settlement in this case?
We've explored the possibilities, and at this juncture, it hasn't moved into any fruitful direction.
We're ready to go to trial. The defendants in this case have not come forward with anything. Obviously, issues like that may or may not be discussed in the future, but I believe that Mr. Paz, who did a majority of the depositions in this case, is ready to go forward.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We've been joined by Samuel Paz and Sonia Mercado, co-counsels in the case of Oliverio Martinez, Alan Wysocki, lawyer for Sergeant Ben Chavez, who interrogated Martinez on the way to the hospital and in the emergency room. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Here we're turning on to 6.03 Radio Santa Cruz. Coming up at 3 o'clock will be Cut Your Hair and Look Up and Job. In today's program, I'm going to be speaking with Ruth Anderson. We'll be talking about the upcoming Sacramento mobilization. Next weekend, June 20th to June 25th, we'll be speaking about that. And I'm also going to rebroadcast an interview I did this morning with Tanya Reinhart, a professor of linguistics at Tel Aviv University. And also, she is a writer for Israel's biggest daily paper and the author of the book Israel-Palestine, How to End the War of 1948. I'll be rebroadcasting that interview. And I also hope to rebroadcast an interview that V-Man did with Sami Awad of the Holy Land Trust from Palestine.
So stay tuned for that from 3 to 6, and I'll try to put some music in there. There's been a lot of talk this afternoon. Now, what is next on this Democracy Now! From May 30th is actually Sweet Honey and the Rock, and they sing quite a few songs in this segment, and I'm kind of tempted to play it because I remember it was really great when I first heard it. So I'm going to go ahead and play that now, but if someone has something else they'd like to hear, you can call in between now and 3 o'clock when I'll be doing the interview with Luke Anderson and make a request. The number here is 427-3772. That's
427-3772.
You are listening to Democracy Now! That was Langston Hughes here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the renowned civil rights activist Ron Daniels, outspoken expert on police brutality and hate crimes, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he's one of the leaders of the organization's National Police Accountability Initiative. Ron Daniels ran for the U.S. presidency as an independent in 1992 and was a campaign manager in the South for the Reverend Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential run. He also played a leading role in the National African American Leadership Summit and historic Million Man March. This week, he spoke at the Society for Ethical Culture in New York in an event organized by Pacifica's WBAI. Ron Daniels talked about why and how civil rights movement continues today.
Sorry, I was wrong about what was next on this. And I don't have time for this segment. Hopefully you heard it on May 30th, but if you didn't, you can go to Democracy Now!'s website at www.democracynow.org if you'd like to hear that. I'm going to go ahead and put some music on so I can cue up the segment with Sweet Honey and the Rock, and here's some Stringy's Incident.